There are many kinds of museums. From the supersized Smithsonian to the childhood home of Muhammad Ali, from Bangkok to Boston, and everywhere in between. But museum goers only see part of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. There was a moment when critics held a much more central place in American culture. Film critics, book critics, restaurant critics, art critics. We knew their names. They were the tastemakers, the trusted sources. But now, in the age of Rotten Tomatoes and likes and shares, all of us are critics. But a rarefied few have transcended the trends and held onto a corner of the zeitgeist. No American critic has been better at doing just that than New York Magazine's Pulitzer Prize-winning art critic Jerry Saltz. In his new book, How to Be an Artist, he distills his life into a mission statement of sorts. We recently spoke with Jerry from his quarantine hideout, where he's holed up with his wife, New York Times art critic Roberta Smith.
So I guess, you've talked about this a lot, but the idea for the book, the title for the book, all was born out of a cover story that you did for the magazine, New York Magazine. Can you kind of talk about the origins of that? Because it's been a long process from that story to the book and everything else. Was the goal originally to get something like this out of it?
It's a great question. I wrote the book, and before that, the article, as a sort of a note of a hymnal of a memory to my former self. I am a failed artist. I began as an artist. I worked for about 10 years in Chicago, started an artist-run gallery. I was selling my work. I got a National Endowment for the Arts grant, yay. It was vast. I took $2,500 and moved to New York with it. I showed my work. I was written about in art form, but the book is a note to all of the younger selves that are me, that meanwhile, no matter if things were good or bad, there were demons that lived in my mouth, the same ones that live in everyone's mouth that say, in my case, you have no degrees. You didn't go to school. You're a fake. You don't know what you're doing. You've got a bad neck. You can't schmooze. You didn't go to the right. You don't hang out with the cool kids. You certainly don't have money like all of them. Don't we hate all of them? Aren't they the losers and you are the pure one? All of those voices, and sadly, you and your listeners are now listening to someone who listened to those demons. And I stopped making art. And the book is a plea, in a way, to people not to listen to those demons. It's a bunch of tools and prompts and rules and lessons for people to get through the dark nights, the 3:15 a.m.s. And it comes from 40 years of me looking at art, thinking about art, 30 of them remembering the 10 years I spent as an artist, and all of those years of lessons learned from everyone I've ever met. In a way, I want to pass along all the blood that this vampire has ever drunk or drinked and give it back to you, because I just know it can help if you're willing to listen. So
do you consider the book a cautionary tale?
Partly. It's a really great observation and question. I think I do live with that pain every day of what might have been. I then became a long-distance truck driver for 10 years, and I would drive through Tulsa, and I drove to Florida once a month, or to Texas, and sometimes California. Only Jewish truck driver, I think, out there. My handle was the Jewish cowboy, but I was miserable. I lived in hell for 10 years. I knew I had to get back to art somehow. And the cautionary tale is, if anything, much, much more positive, that not everybody that begins, say, as an artist or as a teacher or as a critic or whatever you begin as in your early 20s, most people don't actually end up with that. This book is about that fire that frankly is in everyone, and that while I didn't go on to become an artist, I do have what the book is all about. The book is not about making you a rich and famous artist, although I want all artists to make money and be rich and famous, the good artists, the bad artists, even the very bad artists. It's fine with me. The book is about having a life lived in art, of being part of a conversation of the wider world that really, creativity was there with us in the caves, Jeffrey. It's in every bone of our bodies. Darwin did not write that it was adaptation of the fittest or strongest. It's a tragic sort of misunderstanding of him, and he spent his whole life trying to, like a bad tweet, trying to kind of explain himself. What he said was, survival depends on those most able to adapt. And now, unfortunately, in these hard times and these dark nights, all of us are being called upon to adapt in real time. For 50,000 years of our existence, art was made in very similar circumstances to how everyone is making something now, in smaller spaces, under more intimate circumstances, under pressure, with the dog running around over there, somebody cooking over there, Nana trying to wash your clothes, kids running in and out or playing video games, that for 40 or 50,000 years, everything our species ever made, all the invention that we came up with to survive was made in a room that was a kitchen, a studio, a temple, a pharmacy, a rec room, a playroom, a place to have sex. I don't know, but that is the miracle that's happening now. And what I guess I want people to do is, you're also working in a time where the harsh light of outer criticism is gone. Nobody's watching you. You can do anything you want. I want people to get over the fear of and learn to be embarrassed. Anytime you make anything, I promise you it's embarrassing. When I listen to this podcast, that right now I think I'm being completely lucid, right, and honest, I'll go, oh, you know, what a mess. I can't believe I sound that way. I said this way. You have to be willing to be radically vulnerable, which means speaking in your own voice, that little dance you've always thought about doing or that you'd already do in private, you can Instagram it right now. That funny song that you had this idiot idea to write about, you can write it, that you're free, ironically, in this terrible moment. And anything you make, everything you do, without any map, with no rules, no one knows what art is until they make it, you will then be able to carry forward after this passes, because viruses come, but they also go. Art has been with us since the beginning. It will be here on the other side of this. It has never not been here. The book is about that, about getting to work. And this is where I have to get a little rough with your listeners. I need you to get to work, you big babies. Not working is the easiest thing in the world to do. Believe me, I know you did it today. Your wife did it. Your dog gets to have a lifetime of it. But working is the only thing that takes the fear and the curse of not working away, the foulness, right? And so I need people to get up and sit down and get to bloody work. I don't care about what you want to do. I don't care about what great ideas you have, frankly. I'm only interested in, as Wallace Stevens said, the thing in itself. I want you to develop your own skill. Oh, I can't draw Jerry. I can't take a good photograph. You have to stop worrying about making something good or that it will be bad. 95% of the stuff I make is bad. And then I send it to my editor and he makes it better. And then I hope that about 1% of what I wrote turns out to be something that's halfway decent and that is written in my own voice. But you can only do that, again, if you're willing to get embarrassed, to get lost in the work. Let the work, you know what Bob Dylan said? He said, it's like there's a ghost inside of me writing the songs. We don't know really where they came from. I'm 69 years old, so I come from a former world where I actually believe that art might be a universal force using us to replicate itself. Now, again, that's only based on that it's never not been here. I don't think that creativity is any more or less important than philosophy, religion, economics, any field, frankly. I don't think it's a decorative hedge in front of the Citadel College. I think it's part of the whole ball of wax. And right now, listeners, you are being conscripted. You've been drafted, my loves, and everyone will meet the call. No one has never not been creative. Anything you want to do in this period, do it. Great art came out of slavery, out of the concentration camps, out of the gulags, out of World War II, out of every place. In 1918, during the last pandemic, some of the greatest art ever made in the 20th century was made.
Let's talk about museums for a second. Okay. Mm. Museums have not been around forever. And the way museums are structured now is in some ways a fairly new concept. They're struggling right now, like everybody else. Do you have any thoughts about what the museum field will look like 6 months or a year from now?
I really do, Jeffrey. And I just wrote a piece called, it just came out an hour ago, called The Last Days of the Art World and Maybe the First. Museums are ecstasy machines for me. They are wormholes where I go to commune with the ancestors. I go to MoMA, even though the place makes me crazy half the time before they rebuilt it just again. But I go to MoMA to return to the Garden of Eden, something that every book ever written says you can't do. But everyone in the art world knows that it takes a lifetime to see works of art, and you still never see them quite, and that museums are a place where art stands still for about a lifetime, which is about what I'm looking for. Museums are in deep, deep, deep trouble in the United States. They are not funded by the government, unlike in most of Europe and much of Asia. There are four museums with very, very deep pockets. That's the Getty, the Kimball, MoMA, and the Met. The Met just had to lay off about half of its workforce. It estimates it's going to lose about $3 million, or it might have been a much higher figure just from this. And that's our richest institution. Any institution that earns any of its income from, say, event rental, which is a very, you know, it sounds like so crass, and I used to laugh at it, but every night when we stop communing with the ancestors, people with money go into these hallways and have dinner, and they give speeches, and they leave a lot of money behind.
Weddings, all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
Everything. And we make fun of it, but they're paying for my phony baloney job, essentially. So that 30% of their budget comes from the museum shop, the event rental, and to a certain extent, admission. Those museums cannot survive the way you now know them. As much as we've had contentious 25, 35, 40 years with museums, they are going to be stripped down to the bare essentials, Jeffrey. I'm afraid I am for the survival of the museum. I'm afraid that's where I come down on this issue. What programs will be cut? Answer, many, many. How long will shows be going? Much longer. Will there be gigantic art fairs anymore? Only a few. That's over. Is that connected to museums? Indeed, it is, because all those museum boards used to get all hyper from being shipped all over the goddamn world, to drink in the same hotels. Again, they made me crazy and they make you crazy, but all of that money somehow got into our lives, right? The museum stayed open. Only Basel will stay operating because they own their own convention hall. They can do whatever they want with it. The British are brilliant at sort of stagey, theatrical, glitzy productions. So I'd say Frieze will survive. That's art fairs. Auctions, unfortunately, I think are the cockroach in the coal mine that will survive. They have a very small footprint, relatively just one small building, and everything's moving through them. They probably will survive unless fat cats stop buying at auction because they're not doing these insane, obscene amounts of money, public displays. Will they buy if the hierarchy pecking order clout of power is not performed like a big colorful bird in public? I wonder. The San Francisco Art Institute, the museum school, has already announced there will be no incoming class. That's 150 years old institution, very old institution. Art schools got much too expensive, Jeffrey, as you well know, but we are about to lose a century's worth of infrastructure, which means hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people that work in all of these places are in jeopardy. Shall I go on?
Well, I'm curious to know what you think. What's some positive stuff that you see could come out of the kind of minimization of all this?
Here's what's beautiful about art and why I talk over and over about how it's in every one of us, or creativity, and why all of this, I think, will be fine. What I think is it will be different. Here's what I think. Again, I'm older. I witnessed the very last minutes of a different art world of the 1970s, an art world when we had an underground. An art world when I was a truck driver that I called the Paula Cooper. I made a delivery at the great Paula Cooper Gallery, and she and the artist who would end up being very famous, Robert Gober, said, "Oh, come on in, have cigarettes and coffee." And we talked about art for an hour. An art world where I called one of the most famous dealers ever, Marion Goodman, to arrange a delivery. She picked up the phone. When I was there, we did the paperwork. An art world where I saw pure art history, John Cage sitting in a diner having a cup of coffee, an art world where I saw the sum of all things, John and Yoko, making waves of shock as they glided down Madison Avenue. Our art world became beautiful, but very professional, efficient, and safe. Our answer to every question was to get bigger. The art world I know, the art world of all the people listening, who you are, we are outlaws, ne'er-do-wells, geniuses, visionaries, people like me and probably you, that frankly, this is our last stop, man. We can't do anything else. We're almost useless in the real world. I know, I worked there. I was a mess. And I would have been a mess today still doing it. The art world is not efficient, it's eccentric. Does it sound romantic? It might sound that way, but I don't mean it that way. I mean that when you strip it all away, that's what all this is anyway.
And you think it's going to be a level playing field? You think it's going to level the playing field?
Much, much more. Yes, the same way in Trump's stimulus that fast food places have a seat at the stimulus table and Amazon does, and they will survive. We didn't have a seat at that. So while fast food might survive in the art world, it might be our equivalent, which is the mega galleries. They might survive. I don't begrudge anyone surviving. But what I want to say is that we are so lucky. Everyone listening to this, not because of the death, please don't misunderstand me, that you listening to this are being tasked, given the opportunity to build a new art world on the other side of this. There will be a need for it. People will put on beautiful dresses and beautiful clothes again. People will want to go to parties and behave stupidly. I will, after every crisis. We do that. That's okay with me. That's human nature. But the infrastructure that we knew is probably dying, which means you will be able to do what I got to do. I built this city, right? It became weird. It became ugly, but it changed the world and how the world sees itself. We introduced, all of us together, art to the world. Yeah, the filters that came down sure got gross. That happened. 99.99% of us never saw that 1% of 1% of 1% of the money, the glitz, the glamour. We'd get jealous of it, envious of it, yell about it, write about it. That was fun, you know? But it's changing. I couldn't tell you how lucky you are to be going through not this, but what will be left for you. Will it be a depression on the other side? It very well could be. I lived on the other side of the law with not paying rent in a building run by drug lords with no heat. It wasn't fun. I will never glamorize it. I have a fear of big dogs, and the drug dogs lived in the hallway. And I had to walk past these biting German shepherds to get home. Once the door of my apartment was unscrewed off the hinges so they could rob me. None of this is romantic. None of it is easy. And yet art got made, right? A world was put together by vampires like you and all of your listeners staying up late together in mad love, having terrible fights with each other, sleeping with each other, swearing you'd never see each other again, and then the next morning being best friends. That is what the art world is. It isn't this other tremendous, gigantic structure. Museums, I love you. Many of you are going to survive in an altered fashion. If you build it, we will come. If anyone builds it, everyone will come. Every little thing we do, we will attend. That's what we do. And This book will help you get through it.
I'm curious to know how you feel about the timing. That, you know, obviously no one saw this coming a year ago when you were planning the book or beyond that. But it has entered the world at an interesting moment, right? Also the fact that, you know, you talked about the way we value the art world and the money component. The fact that we have to be secluded, as opposed to any other economic problem or recession or anything else, has kept us from the art world, and not just the art world, I mean broadly, like movies, everything, culture generally. Do you think that us having to be separated from that will make it more important for the average person to want to engage with art, as opposed to any other larger economic calamity or anything that's happened before, just because of the distancing problem that we're having right now and the hunger that we feel?
It's a beautiful rhetorical question you ask, like a need, you use the word, a hunger, a desire. I know that lives in me, and it lives in any person you've ever seen in an overcrowded, annoying museum. Turn to anyone on your left. Ask them, what do you think of this painting? And I promise you, I do this every day, trying not to annoy people. It will astonish you what other people are thinking. I have stolen some of my best ideas. People will want to come back. We will come back. The hunger is there, as Jeffrey says. And I don't know. A great artist named Buford Delaney, African-American artist, moved to New York from, I think, Alabama, the day before the Great Depression. An incredible story. He arrives in New York on October, whatever that was, 29th, 1929, whatever the date was, with no money. And the whole place has just died. And he walks from downtown, falls asleep in Central Park, somebody steals his shoes, finishes the walk to get to Harlem, where somebody gives him a job in a basement, like doing nothing. Well, people survived that. My father walked out of Estonia when he was a young man to Germany, got on a boat, came here as an illegal alien. I am Trump's worst nightmare. I am an anchor baby, you know, an Estonian anchor baby, not brown, but very pasty. And that was hard. Everyone has built a world. Now we are going to build a world as opposed to live in the dying skyscraper. And will our other problems wait for us when we get there? Yes, they will. The waters are still rising, kids. You know, the left and the right, maybe people will revolution. But that's not my concern now. My concern is just that people just get on with your work and stay together with each other. Stay up every night with podcasts like this. I'm blown away that you've asked me to do this. And to finish one little other thought you asked, I had one book stop on my book tour in Toronto. And for 2 hours, I was the center of attention. It might have been the happiest 2 hours I've ever had. There was a line going out the door for hours. I went the full Elizabeth Warren and like took pictures with everybody and signed books. And 2 days later, my book came out and the world shut down. I had no book event, no 45-day book tour was canceled. And I realized on the other side of it, Jeffrey, that one great little moment in Toronto of feeling like a god, you know, and being smitten with me, I realized that I had already done almost everything I wanted to do. I danced naked in public for people and made myself radically vulnerable with the book. I had my little book event and big book event in Toronto, and I had an object, you know? I embedded myself in material, my flawed self, my best self, my worst self, my lost self, every self that I might have had access to I did that. And for even if it's not a good book, even if it is a great book, I got almost everything I needed out of it. And that's a big lesson that I'm going to take forever going forward. Just the definition of success is time. The time to work. I already know somebody that died of coronavirus. My niece and nephew both have it. They're young. They're doing well. They have a kid. They live in a crap hole in New York City, right? They're going through this. You're going through it. Our listeners are going through it. And I don't know. I don't have an answer to that, but each of us has to get on with our work. That's what our DNA was made for.
My last question is this. You are famously out and about seeing galleries and going to museums. I think I once heard you talk about how many you went to a week, and it was a lot.
20 to 30 a week. My wife, Roberta Smith, the art critic for the New York Times, that's all our whole life. We don't have another life. This is it.
So what has it been like to just all of a sudden full stop, not be able to do that? Just from a physical standpoint, one, it's just getting out and getting around. And, now you're kind of secluded there. What's that been like psychologically for you in the last couple of weeks?
Well, the withdrawal symptoms are severe, insane. Like, load me up. I'm like that first scene in Apocalypse Now. The first line is shit. Saigon. I thought I was home. I need a mission. And that's how I live every second. Shit. I need a mission. And I don't have a mission. But nobody does. So I have to find my own mission, like everybody does. And I've decided to use it as an opportunity to attempt to listen, to get quieter in this pause that nature has forced on us. And try to glean these weird warblings that I've always sensed are there in older art. A chance to deepen my work, if it's possible, if I'm okay at it, and try to get in touch with. I just wrote, for example, on older art, in this case, Bruegel's The Triumph of Death. Do you know this painting?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Listeners, it's in the Prado. It's painted by Peter Bruegel, who lives up in Antwerp, 1562. He's part of the Protestant Reformation, but their country is run by Spain and a little thing called the Inquisition, where there was mass torture and death going on around him and plagues, okay? The painting depicts from left to right, top to bottom, border to border, an army of skeletons, maybe 100,000 little skeletons. They're ripping apart everybody, hanging people, having hellhounds chase them down. A king is trying to hold on to his fortune while he's being torn apart by skeletons. Lovers are singing to each other while they're being serenaded by another skeleton. The clock strikes death. There is no redemption in this work, no hope, no good death, no afterlife, no nothing. But yet, for my whole life, I've gleaned that that's not all there is in this most bleak painting of a most bleak scene. And I finally got it. It was right there in front of my eyes, and it's exactly what's there in every work of art. Love, courage, care. If you look at a Bruegel, and please, listeners, look at a Bruegel and look real close, every millimeter of every micrometer of every detail of every detail, he's been there. He's trying to give you his story, his voice, his self in everything he's painting, and he's there waiting for you. That painting changed for me. And he was waiting for me. And there's a lot of art like that that I want to take this short 18-month, two-year pause. That's what I think it could be in America. But I'm kind of a, Estonian pessimist. But if I survive this, and I'm in, risk categories, my wife is in several very high-risk categories. But if we survive it, that's what we're both trying to do with our work too, just try to take it deeper.
That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.